You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 26th of March to the 1st of April 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy news editor John Morgan and writer Matthew Rice. The winners and losers in the latest round of Hefke funding allocations are revealed in this week's edition. The first allocations, of course, post-REF 2014. We'll hear more about that in just a second. We also have a little bit more information now about what the postgraduate loan scheme might look like. That was announced in Chancellor George Osborne's budget, of course, but the details are starting to emerge. And Matthew has been to Palestine to find out how scholars there cope with current constraints and indeed look ahead to potentially becoming an independent state. That's to come later, but first, there's no doubting the big news this week. Research funding allocations make the first four pages, in fact, of the news section. I spoke to Paul Jump, Deputy Features Editor and our research expert, a little bit earlier about his coverage. So, Paul, the Hefke funding allocations take up the first four pages of the news section this week, which they do every year, of course, when they come out, or they certainly take up a large chunk of our coverage. I mean, most people will know what it is, so very briefly, what is it? And then maybe you could take us through what the headlines are this year.
Yeah, well, the funding allocations are just the amount that each university gets every year from Hefke as a direct grant, and it's split up into knowledge transfer, research and teaching. I've focused essentially on the research element, just for two reasons, really. I mean, the big one is, of course, the REF. Mm. These are the first research allocations to be informed by the results of the 2014 REF. And also, of course, in the wake of the REF, Hefke revised their funding formula to give more weight to four-star research on the basis that there was a lot more of it around in the REF. So, you know, we're interested to see the effects that's had on the on who gets what, basically.
Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, if you were to look at the most successful performers in the REF, does that correspond to more cash from Hefke this time around? I'm sure it's a little bit more complicated than that, but broadly speaking.
No, not really. It's quite difficult to make that argument. I mean, of course, success in the REF, well, it's kind of it's a sort of moot point, really, what that actually means, given that there's many ways to look at success in the REF. Certainly if you look at it in terms of GPA, which is what THE primarily does, there's not much correlation really between having a high overall GPA and getting a lot of money. If you look at research power, which is essentially GPA multiplied by the volume of people submitted, there's a bit more of a correlation there. Mm. But even there, it's not completely clear cut. I mean, in our coverage, we've got a table that looks at the top 10 by GPA in the REF and how they did in funding terms. Just to give you an example, our top institution based on GPA was the Institute of Cancer Research, and that's going to lose 10%, more than 10% of its funding once the transitional funding runs out. I should say for 2015-16 there's a sort of element of transitional funding that Hefke has given to sort of ease the transition a little bit. It's a bit complicated, so I won't go into it in too much, but basically the biggest gaps will appear in 16-17, assuming that is that Hefke gets a flat cash settlement, and nobody knows whether that's true, of course. So the whole thing could be turned on its head after the next spending review, but if it isn't, then there will be some quite big changes in 16-17. I think it's worth saying that probably the one that we highlight the most is the University of Manchester, which is going to lose by far the most money compared to other institutions.
In cash terms or in percentage terms?
In cash terms, it's going to lose 14 million. That's still a big percentage. That's 17% of its budget. Mm-hmm. This is 16-17, post-transition. That's way bigger. I mean, the second biggest, just to give you an example, is Imperial College, which will lose nearly 5 million. Cambridge will also lose over 4 million. basically that's because they're both science intensive, and science funding as the ring fence around it's been removed, so they're going to suffer for that. Manchester though, it just had a very bad ref. Basically it slipped down the pecking order, and it submitted a lot fewer people, so it's sort of paying the price now.
You mentioned there sort of Manchester's, Oxford's, Cambridge. They're obviously riding high in terms of the biggest cash winners, if you like. But we've also got some analysis in this piece of those institutions that have the highest percentage increase in funding. And there's maybe some less prestigious names there. I think Edge Hill are top, Bedfordshire second, Huddersfield, Canterbury, Christchurch, Northumbria, Lincoln. These are sort of quite interesting findings, really, aren't they?
They are. I mean, it's worth saying that a lot of these places start at quite a low base, so even if they get a little bit more extra cash, you know, it makes quite a big percentage difference. Having said that, though, even if you look at the list of the biggest winners just in cash terms, which we also do, I mean, there are quite a number of post-92s in there. Northumbria, for example, is the fourth biggest winner of cash. Huddersfield's also in the top 10, Middlesex, Liverpool, John Moore. So, there have been some significant gains by the post-92s. And that's sort of reflected in the overall picture. If you look, we've got a graph of how much the Russell Group gets and how much the post-92s get and that kind of thing. And the balance has shifted a little bit away from the big boys. Not massively, but the smaller institutions have got a slightly bigger slice of the pie. Having said that, the biggest cash winner is King's College London, University College London second, Exeter third. So that, you know, the big boys are sort of at the very top of the list. But
all those figures and more are available in the magazine, as stated, and of course at timeshighereducation.co.uk as well. Postgraduate loans, moving on. John Morgan, probably come to you for this. The consultation has launched. That happened just after THE went to press. Some concerns about what they might look like raised both by that consultation and indeed in your story in the magazine this week.
That's right. So the consultation wraps up the plans for postgraduate loans that were announced by George Osborne in the autumn statement in December. And that was a plan for loans of up to £10,000 for postgraduate taught students. And then in this month's budget, we had his plans for PhD and research master's loans, which would offer students up to £25,000. So there are some concerns, although the ideas have been broadly welcomed, but one concern in relation to the PhD loans proposal is that this could be a way for the Treasury to pave way to cuts for the direct public funding for PhDs, which, given there is going to be a lot of pressure on biz to find cuts post-2015, whatever the makeup of the government, you would think, the research budget could be seen as one potential area that hasn't yet been trimmed, and potentially PhDs might be seen as an area that would be kind of most ripe for cuts in the research budget if you had a loan scheme and alternative. But to be very clear, the government has been insistent that this loans funding for PhDs is in addition to the direct public funding that's already in place.
I think it's interesting to look at the actual quote, though, which kind of is, I suppose, typical for any departmental government quote at this crucial juncture just before a general election, when in 2 months we might have a completely different government. There are no plans to reduce or withdraw grant funding for postgraduate research.
I'm sure
there are no plans. There's probably no plans to do very much at the moment, because there might be another government in 2 months' time. New government wants to do, well, we'll have to wait and see. It's all up for grabs.
Yeah, that's a good point, that there are no plans is part of the code of government communiques. And another interesting point in the consultation that the government put out on the loans was, so particularly in relation to the PhD loans, there was a question about whether those should be limited to specific subjects that have the strongest scientific and economic case. So sounds like they could be limited to STEM subjects, these PhD lines, which would be, you know, pretty controversial.
How do you measure the economic strength of a subject, though, or of a particular course?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, scientific and humanities research has had completely unexpected commercial benefits. It would be, you know, quite hard for the government to pin down what PhD research is going to have an economic benefit.
There's so many ways to measure as well. I know we had some information quite recently in the magazine about the lifetime earnings of graduates and experts in different disciplines, and often the humanities can yield people who earn a lot more over their lifetime. Is that an economic benefit? It might, you know, it might not enter that scientific realm that you described, but it's
the figures on the disciplines that postdoctorate employees, where they enjoyed the most money, it seemed to be social sciences, actually, which would surprise me. In some ways, but yeah, that goes to show that although, yeah, there may be a private benefit, I suppose, they're still paying tax.
Yeah. How do you measure these things? Well, that consultation's live now, and I imagine we'll be following it quite closely.
Well, there's still scant details, no word on how much the PhD loans will cost and how they'll be restricted, and still questions about the postgraduate talk loans and whether they'll be restricted to people under 30 as proposed, so there's plenty more still to track.
Indeed, yeah. Watch the upcoming editions of the magazine and the website for the latest. Our lead feature this week, Matthew, is one of yours. You've been out to the West Bank where you met with academics. What did you find?
Well, it's a very complicated and, you know, basically rather depressing situation. I mean, the universities... I couldn't go to Gaza, of course, it was far too dangerous, but I did go visit quite a few institutions on the West Bank. And there's no doubt that there's a lot of... some of the separation wall sort of encroached on the territory, the campuses, in quite a few cases. There are lots of raids of one sort or another by the Israeli police and soldiers. For various reasons, mainly claimed to be to do with security. There are obviously all sorts of checks at checkpoints all the time. So that's one issue. The other issue is the Palestinian Authority has very little money, and I think it's fair to say that research has not been been treated as a top priority. Insofar as there's money for education, it tends to go at other levels of education. So these universities are pretty squeezed. And pretty in a lot of difficulties, really.
I noticed in your piece you said when you were speaking to someone from Al-Quds University, apologies if I'm pronouncing that wrong, but they told you that their campus was attacked 28 times in one semester last year with rubber bullets, tear gas, sound bombs. You visited a number of campuses. Did you get the impression that these were locations under threat?
Well, I was there at a rather strange time because it happened that a Palestinian minister had a heart attack after being tear gassed by Israeli soldiers. So the mood was rather tense, and there were one or two campuses I didn't actually visit precisely because it was a tense time.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, there is a lot of tension, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of despair. On the other hand, obviously, life goes on. There are a lot of students there all the time. And what I did, I met up with quite a few Palestinian academics, many of whom had gone off to America for PhDs and often had professorships in America and decided to return. And I was talking to them about resistance, whether you can just kind of get on with your work, usually in collaboration with other universities elsewhere, because the infrastructure in science is fairly not terribly sophisticated by international standards, what they can do and how much it's worth sort of looking forward to the possible Palestinian state, independent state, which at the moment seems pretty unlikely, but clearly it's something that people think about. And I mean, but then on the other hand, you get into these issues which you get everywhere about what's the point of the humanities. And I did meet one American Palestinian who's an expert on vampires and fantasy literature, and I did sort of raise my eyes and say, well, this may be all very well in some circumstances in rich countries, but surely this isn't the kind of research that the average Palestinian needs. And he sort of put me right. He said that he actually thought that research in fantasy literature can be very important in helping you forge national identities and so on. So all these debates are going on.
Fascinating stuff. Well, you get the full feature from page 38 in this week's magazine, and of course online. This is the first issue review we've had for several weeks. That doesn't mean we've been shortchanging you. If you go to the podcast section of the website, there's all sorts of up there to catch up with. We've coverage from the JISC 2015 DigiFest, an interview with a Fields Medal winning mathematician, and also coming out at the same time as this podcast is our latest books podcast, in which Karen Shook, our books editor, interviews Tommy Dickinson about his book of the week, Curing Queers, Mental Nurses and Their Patients, 1935 to 1974. That's book of the week in this week's magazine. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If there's anything you wish to comment on that we've discussed in this edition, or indeed anywhere else in the magazine, please do get in touch. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You'll also find us by searching on Facebook, on LinkedIn and on Google+. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.